Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. Our guest this evening is none other than Susie Fischbein, the author of the wildly successful Kosher by Design series. 10 years after her first one, she just published her 8th book, a book I have in front of me, very beautifully designed, very carefully explained, Kosher by Design Cooking Coach. Good evening, Susie.
Hi, Chaim. How are you?
Baruch Hashem.
Good.
So, tell me, how did you get into cooking?
I always did like to fuss in the kitchen. I tell the story often that I took a book out of the library when I was probably around 12 years old on how to make centerpieces that look like floral centerpieces out of vegetables. And you one of the flowers was you made this big, beautiful onion mum out of an onion. And I remember my parents, they such schutzkitz in the shemas, we left that centerpiece on the table till it was rotting so that a neighbor walked in and said, "You have got to throw that away." It is stinking up the neighborhood, but they didn't want to throw out my handiwork, so it stayed for a while. And I did like to fuss in the kitchen and make things, you know, that were a little fancier. But then I went on and I became a teacher, you know, and cooking just became something that I liked to do on the side. Then I, you know, moved out to the suburbs and I started working on a volunteer cookbook for my children's school. And really just fell in love with the whole business of writing cookbooks and really found something I was passionate about and that I enjoyed and that I seemed to have a knack for.
I have attended some of your demos, especially here in Brooklyn, especially the ones that you've given at Pomegranate,
mm-hmm.
which is my neighborhood. And it's quite obvious that you're still a teacher and you're very good at it.
Well, I appreciate that, although I have to say Pomegranate makes everyone look good. They're just such a class operation, and the way that they have those shows set up, you look like a rock star, even if you had never stepped into a kitchen. So I appreciate it, though, and I really do love the teaching aspect of my job, because in addition to writing the books, the way that I keep in touch with my audience and the way that I know what to be writing about and what speaks to people and what doesn't is that I do give a cooking class every single week someplace in this country, sometimes even within this world, every single week for the past 10 years. And thank God I'm booked for the foreseeable future, almost, you know, deep into next year. And that's really the way that I know, you know, what my audience is looking for and what works and what doesn't. You know, I came out with my first Kosher by Design and it was a huge success and I thought I had a great formula there and very quickly came out with the second book. But after being in front of audiences and hearing that if a recipe does not have a picture, nobody will ever make it, well, I learned that lesson. And every single book after that, we, you know, Art School is very generous with their budget, and we go to the expense of photographing every single recipe. So
and
that's not something you would know if you weren't hearing that over and over from audiences.
Right. And you've used John Uher a few times, and every time I see his photographs, he gets better and better.
He is an incredible talent. I have to be honest, he was an incredible talent before me. I did not discover his talent, although the way that I got to him is actually a nice story. When I worked on the original, the school cookbook that I was talking about, and the cover of that book was really, really a spectacular picture that fit very well into the theme of the book. And so I tracked down the book. It was from Jacques Therese's book, Dessert Circus. He's a very famous not kosher chef, and he put out a cookbook, and it was this gorgeous picture. It was not the cover of his book, but it was buried someplace in the book. And I called the publisher, and they said, "Well, we don't own the rights to the pictures, but here's the name of the photographer." And this was all before, you know, Google was really Google, and it wasn't so easy to track people down and communicate with them, but I did find him, and he happened to be in New York, and I went knocking on his door, and I said, "You know, my kids go to a local day school, yeshiva, and we're working on this book. Would you donate the rights to this photo?" And he could not have been a bigger mensch. He is just the loveliest man, and he did. He gave us, you know, the rights to the photo. And then when I was able to actually hire a photographer when I started working for Art Scroll, I said, "You know what, Hakarat HaTov dictates, let me go to the guy who, you know, gave me the cover for a charity cookbook." And to say that that was my mazel is just an understatement, because he just has an eye and just has a style, and he makes everything leap off the page. He actually does all the shooting for Godiva. So another benefit is when I have my days of photo shoots, we get through them because we get to snack on Godiva truffles from morning till night. Wall to wall in his studio.
Do you need any assistance?
I get that a lot, Chaim. I get a lot of offers for free workers.
Now, when you started with the idea of Kosher by Design, first of all, what you said after being in charge of the cookbook for your kids' yeshiva, you got the idea that you like this and you'd like to write your own.
Right.
How did the name Kosher by Design come about?
I knew I needed the word kosher in the title because I knew who my audience was. And I kind of have liked the idea that the word design has that double entendre, design meaning style, and design meaning by choice. And I felt that that really captured, you know, these highly stylized, beautiful recipes of people who are choosing to eat a certain lifestyle. So it kind of fit.
And how did you get to art school?
So my first job actually was not for Art Scroll. After, you know, when I just did decide to go out and look for a job, at that time, the Union Square Market, funded by the BID, which is the Business Improvement District of that area of Manhattan, had funded a cookbook about their green market, and it got a ton of media and a ton of attention, and it brought a lot of people to that area. And so I had read that someplace in a newspaper, and I thought, I have a great idea. Grand Central Terminal was just reopening at that time. We're talking about 12 years ago now. Grand Central Terminal was reopening in all of its grandeur and splendor, and it was all about the restaurants and a food court and all these little boutiques of different foods. And it was not kosher. It was Grand Central Terminal. But I approached their BID, their Business Improvement District, and asked if they would model off of what happened at Union Square. And they loved the idea. You know, they said it would be a good souvenir for people coming to New York. It would be a reason to get, you know, news cameras and people coming to talk about, you know, what's going on there. And we were in really, you know, steep negotiations, actually very close to signing on a deal. And, in fact, it was really a good deal for them, too, because they were going to get the restaurants to chip in, like, to get the book together. It wouldn't have to all come out from them. And that was literally, like, the day before September 11th of 2001.
Ouch.
And when that happens, all of the money for any kind of, you know, superfluous projects obviously dried up and everything went into security.
Right.
But at that time, I was still selling the cookbook for my kids' school on a daily basis from my bedroom. And I, you know, had gotten to know over 2 years all the Jewish bookstore owners all across the country. And again, this was all pre-Amazon, so everybody who wanted a Jewish book went into a Jewish bookstore and got to know their Jewish bookstore owners. It was really quite a lovely time. And I was talking to Tuvia from Tuvia's Bookstore. In Muncie, just the loveliest, most friendly guy. And he would always kibitz with me and say, so when are you going to write another cookbook? So this time when he asked me, I said, actually, Tavia, I got and lost my first job before I even wrote a recipe. And I told him my sad saga. And he says, well, that's because you never should have been writing a Trafe cookbook. I said, so what am I supposed to do? He said, I know what you should do. He said, I have friends at Art School. He said, they get calls from Yentas all the time who are looking to write cookbooks for them. It's never the right fit. They're smart business people. But I think you are the right fit, and I'll make a call to get you an interview. And he did. And they did take a gamble on me, Gedalia and Rabbi Zlatowitz. It was definitely, you know, we didn't know we had a sure thing, and these books are, you know, pretty expensive and extensive, you know, to write.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my gamble was spending the time writing it, and their gamble was financial, and we just hit it right. We had just such good mazel and being in the right place at the right time. Just the audience was hungry for it. Kosher people were hungry for something beautiful and upscale and not traditional. And, yeah, and it's been just a great relationship ever since.
As I'm looking through your current book, Cooking Coach,
yes,
I happen to look up what you have about turkeys, and I see you have this beautiful roast turkey with maple mustard glaze. personally, I happen to like poultry with mustard. So that immediately got my attention.
It happens to really complement turkey, especially maple syrup and mustard. And this recipe only has five ingredients. I mean, it couldn't be easier.
Right, right. And the more I read that recipe, the more I'm sure that that's the one I'm making.
You will not be disappointed. Just follow the instructions on how to roast a turkey. You know, you have to start it with the breast side down and tent it, and then you have to turn it after an hour. It's very simple. You just have to follow the timing, and you'll have a perfect result.
And, of course, I can't wait to make the carried turkey salad.
With the leftovers.
With the leftovers, right.
So you are hinting about a very special aspect of this book. The book is called Cooking Coach, so playing off of the coach theme, at the very beginning of the book, I put in something called a playbook, which tells you, it's both from an economic standpoint and from a time-saving standpoint of, you know, everyone wants to have a nice meal on the table every night, but we don't always have the time. And if you've already made something, you don't really want to spend the money on making something else just because your family says, we don't love leftovers. So this playbook tells you in advance, this is what you can do with the leftovers. So what you're referring to is a curry turkey salad, or then you can use the carcass to make a turkey soup. And a lot of these recipes are completely reincarnated into something completely unrecognizable, which is a really cool thing, you know, a great fresh way to turn your leftovers into something that your family hasn't seen, you know, before.
Right. And you also have one of my favorite recipes on chicken, Cornish hen imported chocolate sauce. I've done something very, very similar without the chocolate sauce, but the idea sounds absolutely delicious.
It's really amazing. And I got that recipe from Naomi Caterers. My family spent some time in Portugal for my daughter's bat mitzvah. We went to Spain and Portugal. And we joined up. It was an Emuna women's tour of Portugal, and we needed a place for Shabbos for dinner and for davening, and they were there at the same time. And we come into this hotel where we were joining them and sit down in Portugal, where you cannot get anything other than olive oil kosher. I mean, there is just nothing kosher there. When we had asked the Chabad Shaliach, what can we bring you? He said, anything. He said, mayonnaise. He said, we can't get anything other than olive oil here, kosher. So to sit down to this unbelievable meal of Cornish hen and port chocolate sauce, port being, you know, obviously very Portuguese, you know from Portugal.
Of course.
It blew me away. It was incredible. And he shared the recipe with me. And that's the recipe you're referring to.
You have some incredible recipes, even though this book, just by the title, sounds almost like it's for beginners. The fact is you have stuff here to, you know, please every taste.
Right. Well, I appreciate you saying that.
The photography is incredible, and once you see that incredible photography, of course you have to read the recipe. I mean, there is no choice. How do I make it? Briat Savarin, in his La Physiologie du Goût, the physiology of taste, he wrote that the first thing that gets us about a new dish is what it does for our eyes.
Right.
Once
our
eyes are attracted to it, it seduces us with the smell, with the aroma.
Right.
And only 3% of the total experience is the actual taste.
It's true. It's true. You've already won half the battle by visual and then by aroma, and then comes taste. But you're right. Everything else is primed and ready. To have an expectation before the fork even comes. Now, obviously, then the taste matters.
Obviously, it matters. The second time, you need more than just looks and aroma. You better have the taste.
So it has to be the trifecta. It has to be all three.
Absolutely. Now, in this book, not only do you have meat, you have baking, you have everything. You have soups, the work. So basically, as I see it, it's a complete course.
It is a complete cookbook, Chaim, because look, people buy a cookbook at the end of the day for a cookbook, for a recipe, you know, for new recipes, for new ideas. And that's my job as a cookbook author. And I felt my job as a teacher was to do all that additional stuff, all those, again, on the coaching theme before each section is something called a game plan, which gives you instruction, not recipe-specific, but topic-specific. So, for example, in the meat section, we took pictures of every kind of cut of kosher meat. We tell you what different butchers call it because different butchers call things different things, and that's very confusing. But more important than the titles is I try to teach people, I want them to understand, I know when people are thinking about their dinner, they don't really want to be thinking about an animal walking around, but I ask you to just divorce that while you're in this section of the book and learn where things come from on the cow. So why does that matter? Because what I want people to take away from that is, for example, if something comes from the chuck primal, which means it comes from the shoulder or the neck or the chuck, that's a very exercised part of the cow. And think about it. All the cow's weight is on that shoulder. So it has a lot of muscles and tendons, and the meat tends to be very tough, which makes it more economical than, let's say, something from the prime, the rib primal, where that's like, you know, a very fancy part of the cow. It doesn't get a lot of exercise. That's where rib steaks come from. So why does it matter to you where on the cow it comes from? Because if it comes from a very exercised part of the cow, as I said, it's going to need a specific technique to cook it. It needs low and slow cooking in some kind of liquid. What that liquid is up to you, whether it's beer or wine or beef stock or chicken stock or tomatoes. It almost doesn't matter what the liquid is, but you know you need low and slow, a good 2 to 3 hours covered in liquid. So that means if you go to the supermarket and chuck roast is on sale, even though you've never bought it, oh, you know it's chuck. I know how to treat it. You can then either use what's deep fixed in your freezer or what's on sale at the market or something new that you want to try. As opposed to if you brought home a rib steak and you cooked it for 2 or 3 hours in liquid, you would have killed it and wasted your money because it doesn't respond in the same kind of cooking. That needs a quick heat, you know, a quick sear, you know, 10 minutes, you know, per side and in and out and you're finished. So just kind of by educating yourself, it makes you just a more intuitive cook. It'll make you a more confident cook when you know what you're talking about and know what you're dealing with. You can cook what you like, what you have, what your family likes. And again, economically speaking, you know, what's on sale.
Well, as a matter of fact, you have a whole big section with photography explaining the different cuts of meat. And I find that very, very helpful because when I go to the butcher shop, I actually can see what it is I'm getting. I can actually understand where it comes from. And you already are giving me ideas of things I could do with it, which I may not have thought of before.
Right.
Not only may I not have thought of it, I didn't think of it before.
That section is special to me. My grandfather was a butcher, so I felt like the time that I spent, I went to Park East Butcher in the city, and they took me down to their dungeons, is how I refer to it, and basically they taught me how to butcher up a cow, at least the kosher primals, and something in me felt like I was channeling my grandpa. Moshe Sokol from Division Avenue, he was definitely smiling down.
Oh, Williamsburg.
Williamsburg, yes. Both my parents are from Williamsburg, and their parents, too.
Wow.
In fact, my parents always laugh. They met when they were 14 years old at the Young Israel Christmas dance. I guess times were different. The Young Israel, they didn't want the kids, you know, wandering around on Christmas, so they would host a dance, and that's where my parents met.
And that would never happen today. Today we're far too far from.
Yes.
I remember the same thing at when I was in NCSY.
Uh-huh.
The activities that we had in NCSY today would never pass muster, would never happen today.
Right. It's true. Times have definitely changed. Yeah. It's even from the time between me and my kids. So, but they have lots of benefits that we didn't have, and it's just a different time.
That's true. Now, an interesting thing that, again, shows that you are truly a teacher. On the video, which I have on my website,
I saw that
interview that you did with Gila, you said that one of your purposes in writing the cookbook was to actually win people off cookbooks. the cookbook, in other words, was just an idea, a departure point, and that you want them to improvise. Now, one of my favorite teachers when I was in high school in Uruguay, in South America, he was a history teacher. And I remember how the first day he told us, I'm not here to teach you history. I'm going to only give you a few essentials. I am here to teach you how to learn history on your own. And that's basically what you're just saying, by telling people that you want them to win off the book. You're actually telling them the book is a departure point. I want you to learn how to cook on your own.
When I was a teacher, I taught fourth grade in public school, and I had a master's in science. And even at that time, 20 years ago, I knew in my heart that it didn't matter to me if my kids knew one thing that was in any of the textbooks that I gave out, not the science, not the history, not the math textbook. My only goal for the students that passed through my classroom was that they should love learning, they should learn how to learn, they should know how to question, and know how to find answers to their questions. Those are my goals, and it didn't matter. You can plug in any subject. And there's always answers, or there's things you can memorize, or these days there's any answer in the world is someplace out there on Google. But to learn how to be a motivated learner, to know where to go to find your questions, to learn how to formulate questions, that to me is the real job of a teacher. So I felt like, as a cooking teacher, isn't that really my goal? You know, when I first started giving cooking classes, I would race through the recipes and I would, you know, try to make people understand how to make the three recipes that I was teaching at the class. But quite honestly, they were going home with the recipes in their hands. I was giving them the recipes. So that was the one thing that they didn't need from me. What they needed from me when they came to my classrooms were all the other information, the tips, the techniques, the shortcuts that I take for granted, the way I set up my kitchen that, you know, kind of puts things right at hand. People would always ask me, you know, what kind of knives do you use? Or where did you learn what you know? Because I am not classically trained. I do not have a degree in cooking, which I'm actually very proud of. It always comes up at the show. People say, where did you get your culinary degree? And when I say, I don't have one. And when people refer to me as a chef, I am always very fast to correct them and say, I am not a chef. And I hate when people call me a chef because people work very hard for that degree and the ability to be called a chef, and I don't want that honor bestowed on me. I am not a chef, but I actually wear that as a sense of pride because I'm self-taught, which means whatever I learned, you can learn.
Right. But let me tell you something about the people calling you a chef. One of the best chefs I've ever met is an Italian non-Jew by the name of Walter Potenza.
Mm-hmm.
He happens to be the foremost historian. His training is as a history teacher.
Mm-hmm.
He loves culinary history. He's one of the greatest authorities on Jewish culinary history from Italy, and he's writing a book on it.
Now, really?
He never took any classes on cooking.
Mm-hmm.
He fell into it by accident. It was love at first sight. In Providence, in Rhode Island, in Boston, he owns a whole slew of eateries. He owns three cooking schools, two of them in Italy, one here in the States.
Wow.
He teaches people, he gives people the degree of chef, and he himself never took a formal class.
Isn't that interesting?
And he's incredible.
Wow, that's really interesting.
I've seen people walk out of his restaurants and they're all talking about the food like, you know, every time there is something new, every time there is something incredible. So
Right. You
don't have to be trained formally as a chef in order to be a true chef.
Right, right. You just have to have certain intuitions and feel confident
enough to
depart.
Intuition, you have to have a passion for it.
Right.
You have to understand it.
That's true, Chaim, but the truth is people are passionate about things that they tend to be good at. So I feel like if you give people the tools to get good at cooking, it's more likely that they'll find their passion in it. If you dread cooking, it tends to be because you're not good at it, or you make a mess, or your food never comes out right, or it's not seasoned right, or you don't get good response when you serve it. Because let's face it, we all have to put meals on the table, whether it's for ourselves
That's
or
right.
for our families, three times a day. So my feeling is, if you have to do it anyhow, it's not like running a marathon. That you have a choice to do or not to do, and you can choose to train for it or not train for it. But food, it has to get on the table. So get educated, and likely you'll feel better and good about it if you have good results and you get good feedback. So, you know, it's kind of worth the investment in yourself.
Mm-hmm. I am now looking at the game plan on the dessert section, where you talk about the equipment, where you talk about the various ingredients, the differences in flour, for example, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Again, I love the photography. I love the way you explained it. And it reminds me of a book I picked up recently called The Encyclopedia of Ingredients. It was put together by a German company with incredible photography. They explain everything, and they even include some recipes. And it's interesting how your book, in a way, resembles that German book a lot.
Huh.
Beautifully done. So is yours.
Thank you.
And you explain everything beautifully. Truly like an encyclopedia.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Now, I am sure that in your career as a cooking teacher, there must have been quite a few interesting anecdotes. Care to tell us any?
That's a hard one. I've certainly been, you know, privileged to meet lots of, you know, lovely people, all, you know, all around the world, and have had some really nice cooking experiences. I would guess the hardest ones, the ones that stick out the most in my memory, were when things went wrong or things were challenging, like a cooking class that I drove up to in Baltimore. And as I literally walked into the house with my last basket of stuff and equipment, all the power in the neighborhood went out. Having just, you know, recovered from Hurricane Sandy, I think a lot of people can probably relate to what that feeling is when you're standing.
Yeah.
So you can imagine me with, you know, 500 pounds of stuff, an entire minivan worth of stuff that had to be cooked and prepared, and standing there in a strange kitchen in pitch black without any equipment. This was the loveliest group of women, and the summer before, they had had a blackout that lasted for 8 days, and it was a very firm neighborhood. Almost every house was a firm house, so they were all, you know, very like-minded, and they all had full freezers. So husbands and wives together pulled into action during that week. The husbands would break out grills in like cul-de-sacs. They would all bring out their grills, and whatever was defrosting from everybody's freezer, that's what they would cook for the whole neighborhood at dinner. It was like a giant block party. So these guys were professionals. So they kicked it into gear. Everyone started calling their husbands on the cell phone. You got to get a generator. You got to get this. You got to get that. And while they were assembling all the stuff, they lit all these yardside candles, and me and a group of women, almost like in a Kumsitz atmosphere, there was singing, and we were chopping by candlelight and trying to get the show, you know, together. And that one really sticks out in my mind, is really like a very memorable experience. So that was a fun one.
Yeah, I can hear that. Now, so tell me, what is next?
What is next? You know, Chaim, that's never been a question that has ever thrown me before, because as I've been quoted, and it is true, I have always written a cookbook, taken a day off, and started the next cookbook. That was always my tradition. But on this one, I felt like I needed to take a step back and evaluate. I feel like the cookbook world has changed drastically. In the last two books, things have really changed. You know, Jewish bookstores are not surviving quite as well. Regular national bookstores are out of business. A lot of things, you know, there's a lot of blogging going on. There's a lot of things that have changed the face of cooking. It has certainly become in the forefront of everybody's minds. Tons of kids these days want to be chefs. They want to own restaurants. They want to be in the food world. You know, chefs are now rock stars. They're not just people that work, you know, behind a kitchen door. It's become a very big focus of this country, and that has changed the cookbook industry. And I feel like I just want to make sure, before I take the next step, where it is that I think our mazel, mine and Art Scrolls together, has been that we came in at the right time and the right place, And I think that's a huge part of our success. We always stayed ahead of the curve, and then things people followed and piled on behind. And some have done it very, very well. And even some of the ones that have done it very, very well have not really achieved huge success because you always want to be a step ahead. So I just want to make sure. I have a few ideas. We just want to see which one is the right one. I don't mind sharing, you know, what the ideas are. Maybe you'd even have some insight. But if I do go ahead with another cookbook, as I have been writing, I feel like the only audience I haven't addressed yet is men. And I think a really fun cookbook for the Kosher by Design series could be Kosher by Design for Men, Chillin's, Chilies, and Grilling. And that's definitely on my mind. I think it could be a great book. And then the other possibility that's also, you know, being, you know, tossed around is to do an app, which is obviously a hot topic right now. But it's not a matter of just doing an app. It's a matter of doing an app really, really well with all the videos that would be necessary, with all the angles, with all the camera work, with all the things. You know, to have an app that says, oh, yeah, print out this recipe and I'll give you a shopping list or I'll show you how to multiply, that's not worthwhile. I would never produce anything that I myself wouldn't want, need, or buy. And that's always been, you know, that was, I can't remember who, but someone big in finance. My husband would not be impressed that I can't remember this, but he was always at the forefront of the financial world and stocks, and his philosophy was he knew what stocks to buy, and we're talking about like in the 80s. He knew what stocks to buy based on what shopping bags his wife and children were carrying into the house. At that time, the Gap was suddenly becoming big. And when he started to see Gap bags coming into his house on a weekly basis, he knew that was a stock to buy. So that's always been part of my philosophy. I never want to write anything that I don't want to personally eat or own. So,
I understand.
You know, if I'm going to do an app, it has to be of a certain level. I can't just say, oh, here's a Kosher by Design app and expect it to do well. It has to be something that I would think would be groundbreaking in the kosher world. So that's a possibility, too. So, you know, lots of things, you know. The nice thing about this life is new opportunities come up and you never really know where they're going to take you, and you just kind of keep your eyes open.
You're talking about trying to be ahead of the crowd, and I'm looking at the recipe that had you suggested a recipe like this 2-3 years ago, most people would have said, I'm not going to try that. That doesn't make any sense. But it seems to be a trend, maybe. And I'm talking about the ultimate sea salt chocolate chip cookies.
Yep.
Chocolate with sea salt.
Yep.
I've tried it, although at first, you know, my mind says, no, Chaim, that doesn't make any sense. I tried it.
You're not
it was
a woman.
Absolutely delicious.
Ask any woman. Right. Every woman knows salty and sweet is a fantastic combination.
And by the way, what you said about a cookbook for men with chalk and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's interesting, for example, one of the contestants at this year's Iron Chef at the Kosher Fest.
Yeah.
Ari White, he started out by cooking, by making the chalk as a kid.
Oh.
In Texas, he made chalk for his family. He said he always used to fight with his brothers because he always felt it was his job. He loved doing it, and they always did something different week after week. And his first company was called Gat Cholent, which had 26, still has 26 different types of cholent from around the world.
Wow.
And now he's got, for the last 2 years, he's got a catering company that is incredible called Gemstone Caterers.
Wow.
And it's interesting. He started out with cholent.
Cholent is a hot topic these days, and it is specifically a man's domain.
Oh, absolutely.
I actually was just recently invited out. My husband and I were invited out to spend a Shabbos in San Diego, where I judged a cholent cook-off, and I would say half the contestants were men. My first foray into judging cholent contests was at the YU cholent cook-off, which obviously all the contestants were men. I think cholents, chilies, grilling, those are definitely male domains, and I think it could possibly make for a really fun book.
Yes, it should, and I hope you do write it. I can't wait for it. And we're just about out of time. Unfortunately, I did not get to cover all the topics that I wanted to cover.
You and I could talk for weeks on end, Chaim.
Yeah. We're going to have to do this again because there are so many questions I still wanted to ask. But
thank you.
Time is ruthless.
Thank you for having me on.
It was a pleasure to have you. And
let's
do it again soon.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you and good night, ladies and gentlemen. And tune us in again next Wednesday at 10 o'clock. Thank you very much. Good night, one and all.